A Sunday when our efforts and our prayers envision the possibility of unexpected answers. And it's a lot to ask, to invite us into imagining that possibility of mystery beyond our naming. But it's actually a safer risk than we realize. About a decade ago, I was driving with friends up the coast of California on the way to vacation. And we stopped at a rancho in Ventura, a few hours north of Los Angeles. Our destination was a stunningly beautiful mission, a church and grounds left over from times long ago. And as I entered the sanctuary of this church, I heard singing. It was a little cacophonous. It sounded out of sync, not like this choir at all. With beautiful voices not quite in harmony. I just stopped, closed my eyes, and listened. And then I looked around because I wanted to see who was singing. But with the exception of the friend I was traveling with, I found that I was entirely alone in a large, empty sanctuary. And I thought, okay, there's an answer for this. It must be piped music. And I asked the docent, the person available to lead tours. And he looked at me gently, and he said, "You're in a church, one that has hundreds of years of history. These voices you're hearing, their prayers accumulated over hundreds of masses, blessings, weddings, memorials, and celebrations." So I nodded without words to speak and simply sat down. And as soon as I closed my eyes, the sound returned. And I opened my eyes, and silence prevailed. And I tried this a few times, always with the same result. And as I left, I asked my friend, "Did you hear the voices?" Praying honestly that she hadn't, that what I had heard was all in my head. "And yes," she said reverently, "isn't it quite amazing?" And I acknowledged it was, and then sat silent for some time, pondering. Hi, Paxton. I acknowledged what it was, and I sat quiet. Because what was in my head was, why was God, or whatever, there of all places? And I want to explain my confusion. The ranchos in California have a brutal history. First, the Spanish colonized the indigenous population in devastating ways. Mexico did the same to the Spanish conquistadors, and then the white men came and did the same to what we would now call the Mexicans. All of this done in the name of faith, well, in truth, profit and power were very strong motivating factors. And this is why I had stopped there, to read about and understand some of that history. I felt uneducated about the church's role, and I wondered how these monuments to so much sadness remain standing as edifices to troubled past. But where I expected fear, I heard prayers. Where I had anticipated loss, I felt faith. And maybe God, depending on how one defines that. I can assure you it was a transcendent experience, and one that didn't make sense. Why would beauty show up there where I least expected it? Why does faith persist despite so much human imperfection? And what would it mean if hope was always, always available to us?
Okay, we're gonna give the kids a chance to stretch their legs. If you wanna come forward and hear a story, any kids or kids at heart are welcome up here. Yeah, take a seat. This is turning into a lovely morning, so the rest of us can take a minute to breathe and enjoy the misty day we have outside. Let's see if we can. So some of you know our Jewish friends are celebrating the holiday of Passover. And on the first two nights of Passover, they have a special dinner called a Seder. And I want to tell you about one of the things that happens at this dinner. there is an extra place set at the table, and they pour an extra glass of wine and put it there, and then somebody goes and opens the door, and what they're doing is saving a seat for somebody we call the prophet Elijah. And so there's a lot of history there that we don't really need to get into. Long time ago, the prophet Elijah started off as a farmer who challenged the ruling class at his time. And so he's remembered as somebody that stands up for those in need. And so it's also told that before he left this earth, the prophet Elijah said that he would return once every generation in disguise. He would come as a beggar or an oppressed person, and he would knock at the door and see what happens. Will people open their door and their hearts to somebody in need? And so a lot of stories are told about these disguises the prophet Elijah took. And so he's become a very beloved symbolic figure. And so I want to share one of the stories about the prophet Elijah with you this morning. So it starts in a village that's maybe a little bit like this one, maybe a little bit more old-fashioned. And there's an old man and an old woman who live in this village. And they're not wealthy, but they work hard and they share what they have with those who are in need. Sometimes a traveler comes through and needs a place to stay, and they'll make a warm bed by the fire for the traveler. Sometimes if one of their neighbors needs food for their table or shoes for their children, this old man and old woman will help them out and share what they have. But it happens that this village falls on very hard times, and the crops fail, and there is not enough food for everybody, and the winter is very harsh. And so as this happens, everybody gets a little hungrier, and they start to pull their coats a little tighter when they walk out into the street, and they don't meet each other's eyes. And the old men and the old women were also suffering during this time, and they were growing hungrier. Their cupboards are growing bare. And so they make the hard decision to sell their treasured possession. They sell their golden candlesticks that they light every week to celebrate the Sabbath. And so they're sad when this happens. They have to say goodbye to this treasure. But they know that the money from it will help feed them through the winter, that it will be just enough to get them through. So that night, they're sitting together in their cottage, and they're sad. They're preparing to eat their simple stew, and the room seems just a little bit darker than it usually does. And then there's a knock on the door. And through the window, they can see that there's a beggar. There's somebody in need standing at the door. And his feet are dirty, and his clothes have almost been reduced to rags. And he carries a staff in his hand. And it's clear that he's going to want some place to spend the night, and he's going to want to eat some food. And so as the old woman turns to get up and go to the door, the old man puts his hand on her arm and stops her. "Haven't we given enough?" he says to her. And she takes a deep breath. And she looks in his eyes and she sees that there's fear that's maybe gnawing at him just like the hunger was gnawing at his stomach. There is always enough. And she goes and opens the door. She welcomes the beggar in. The old man gets him a bowl of stew, and he puts it before the beggar. He throws an extra log on the fire. And as they talk into the night with their visitor, this traveler, this beggar, the room starts to seem a little bit brighter, and for some reason the stew doesn't seem to disappear quite as quickly. And then in the morning, when the traveler is preparing to leave, the winter wind is still whipping around, and it's blowing leaves and things everywhere. But the traveler thanks them. He says, "You've given me hope." And he walks on down the lane. And suddenly, there's a glint on the ground that catches the eyes of the old man and the old woman. And they turn to look at the path that the beggar has walked off on. And they see that the leaves on the ground are now shining in the sun because they've been turned to gold. And they were glad, as they always are, that they opened the door. So you kids can stay up here now for a few minutes, and I'm going to turn the pulpit over to Reverend D.L.
A few people have already mentioned, of course, the stories of Easter and Passover, the stories of these days. And as we remind ourselves each year, these are somewhat linked celebrations. Passover, of course, is a celebration of the Jews' release from bondage, slavery in Egypt. It was not an easy release. We're told that God had imposed 10 plagues upon the Pharaoh before the Pharaoh would set his Israelite slaves free. But it's about a lot more than that tale. It's a reminder of the truth that we so often remind ourselves, that none of us are free until all of us are free. So the remembrance of Passover is also a call to remember all those still in bondage and to work towards their freedom. Because enslavement can and does end in ways that look like it was without warning. This was true for the slaves fleeing Egypt, whose freedom came so suddenly that the bread was left unleavened, resulting in the matzah that is one of the things that we so enjoy in this remembrance. But we've also seen history repeat itself again and again. When the wall fell in what used to be Eastern Europe, when apartheid ended in South Africa, the end of bondage can look arbitrary and unexpected, though in reality, so many have worked for so long, and yes, they've also prayed for these tipping points, when what looked unimaginable suddenly occurs. And then Easter builds on that notion, because as we've talked about before, Jesus' entire ministry focused on that exact goal, a just society. And then as now, that call for freedom terrified the authorities. What if people knew their rights and their power? What might happen if people came together to end a government that wasn't working on behalf of the people? And because the government was terrified of that happening, they label Jesus an instigator, a heretic, and they call for his execution. Some say his Last Supper would have actually been a Passover celebration, though there's some calendaring that questions that. But certainly that Last Supper was a celebration, and again, a release, a call for release for all those in bondage. And now we get to the point where faith is absolutely needed. Because we know the story at this point says that Jesus died and then came back to life. And as a Unitarian Universalist minister, I can assuredly tell you that I have no idea if that's what actually happened, but I don't think that's really the core of the story. Biblical stories are more moral tales. They tell us a story of something happening, but more importantly, they tell us of what might be. They hold space for some of the best and the worst of human behavior. If Jesus did come back to life, it was by communities of love, the communities that surrounded him, by his friends, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, who kept watch over him like so many of you do over each other. Friends who didn't give up, who prayed for and worked for a better outcome than the one they feared. Earlier this week, as I watched the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris in flames, my heart ached, like I know many of yours did, just as it had been broken for the three black churches in Louisiana which were set aflame in the last week. Just as my heart broke for the mosque in Jerusalem that found itself on fire almost exactly the same time as Notre Dame did. And these edifices to faith, I tell the story of the mission because these edifices to faith, these buildings can be problematic. They can be symbols of all that's wrong with the history of the church, the damage done historically, and sometimes still happening. But we also love them. They remind us of our aspirations. They hold a setting for our hopes and our dreams. So grand, we're almost afraid to put words to them. It's places where we dedicate our children and where we mourn our dead. It's places where we come together to build the world we dream of. This is why Passover and Easter Master. I swear I just created a new holiday. Let me try that again. This is why Passover and Easter matter, where we gather to practice our faith. Wherever we gather, those are holy places. It need not be a church or a temple. Perhaps it is at internment camp or at border walls. Because we lean into the hope when we're desperate enough to make the impossible possible. We pray because there is power to putting words and thoughts and deeds into the world. And we gather together because it's in community that miracles are made manifest. In Palestine, where so many are in bondage still, there are women who have dedicated their entire lives to following the trail of the disappeared, hoping that one day they would have the chance to find those individuals and bring them home. Women in particular, in country after country, years ago and still now, unwilling to accept loss without doing all in their power to bring home their beloveds. They do this. At our southern borders right now, this is playing out every day as communities step forward again and again to care for those on their journey seeking freedom from bondage. So if I had to sum up the world in three sentences, prayers get answered, agitators get outcomes, and the world does move towards justice. Recently, Canada acknowledged the vast mistreatment of Indigenous women over the years and promised to end a centuries-long practice of oppression and violence. And that doesn't change what happened, but it does make for a freer future. And that day in the Rancho, with those inexplicable voices, the prayers spoken over so many years, I felt the possibility of so much more. Enduring longer than violence is the possibility for human hope. More present than the history of repression is the resiliency of the spirit. As I left the grounds of that edifice, I cried. I cried for the loss of so many, of the ways we hurt each other, for those whose lives weren't fully lived. And as my tears dried, I realized that the joy had outlived the pain, that hope and prayer and action had freed those who were held here, and that all that was left behind was the building itself and the strength of the human heart. And that's why we gather today. To recognize our ability to affect change, to remember that we're in it together, and to manifest more than we can imagine. May your celebrations, whatever they are, remind you of your place in the arc of justice, and may you hear the music, even in the silence. The Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, we share common threads. And we all have a way of teaching prayer, of providing ritualized mechanisms for a sharing of that which we hold on our hearts, releasing our fears and hopes into the ether, and understanding that we don't have to carry it alone. And we Unitarian Universalists, we don't have a lot of set ritual because we don't have one vision of what God is or isn't. We journey together. But that sometimes leads us to the conclusion that prayer doesn't belong in Unitarian Universalism, and that would be incorrect. For to pray to something is simply a declaration of our belief in something. And the recipients can be so myriad, from this community to our interconnectedness to that which lays beyond our understanding. So today is a particularly good day to make room for, to remind ourselves of that spaciousness, and to release our deep longings into the universe. Today we try two ways of prayer, one written and one embodied, and we invite you to join in one or both as you are moved.
Reverend D.L. is going to be passing out some materials to you while I'm speaking. So you'll take a strip of wax and a marker. You may need to share the markers with those around you, so try to keep that in mind. Kids, you are going to have little balls of wax like we use downstairs, and your job is going to be to soften it and make a flat shape with it that will go onto a candle. And choir, I believe that you will also get the balls of wax to soften and make a flat shape with. Those in the chairs, you need a marker and a strip of wax. So you may have heard something this morning that moved you. We hope that we've given you the chance to pause and to allow for the experience of something to swell up. Maybe you're moved by the idea of the prophet Elijah and our basic human capacity to feel for those who are oppressed or hurting. Maybe you are in awe of what happens when we take this pause as a group and allow ourselves to feel connected to a larger whole. We'd like to give you the chance to name this sense of feeling. We offer the idea that prayer is nothing more than this. And we also want to acknowledge that there is something powerful in doing this and in doing this together. On the altar, you'll see that there are three large white candles. When we're done this morning, they will be tangible representations of our hopes, our joys, and our prayers that we want to share with the world. We're going to keep one here for future use. And we will gift one to the Muslim Student Association at the University of Rhode Island as a sign of our solidarity with them in a time when they may feel especially threatened. And we will gift the other one to the organization Amor, who works tirelessly on behalf of refugees and undocumented immigrants in our state. By now, you should be holding a small piece of wax. So as you hold your wax, the strips, you don't want to get too soft, but just a little bit soft. If you have a ball, you need to soften it a little bit more. As you hold it, take a minute to soften your gaze and close your eyes. You don't need to look at it yet. Just feel it in your hands. We'll take a deep breath together, and then we'll let it out slowly. So in and out. As you feel yourself surrounded by this place, and these people, and what it means for us to be here together, ask your heart for a word that represents this feeling. When you're ready, write that word on your wax. We'll take a minute of silence together as we do this. In a moment, we'll direct you to come up section by section. As you bring your wax forward, feel it begin to warm and soften in your hands. Imagine that you are infusing it with your deepest hopes for the world. If you prefer to remain in your seats, we will bring a candle to you. When you come up, please attach your wax to one of the candles, adding your prayer to the collective tide of prayers that we honor today. So may it be.